ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey there, I'm Dominique Bayens, host of a new podcast I'm super excited to share with you. It's called Expanse, the NANUP 4, about the mysterious vanishing of four people 2 decades ago and their world of cults and hidden identities. Stick around after this episode of Politics Now to hear a teaser of what you can expect when episode 1 drops on March 3rd.
As the scale of the war in the Middle East widens, US President Donald Trump has warned a big wave of strikes is still yet to come. And while both the Prime Minister and the Deputy Prime Minister have reiterated they don't expect the US to ask for military support, it's not clear how long the events in the Middle East could continue for. But the conflict is already sending shockwaves across markets, with RBA Governor Michelle Bullock warning inflation expectations could become unanchored and refusing to rule out another interest rate hike later this month. Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis.
And I'm Raf Epstein from ABC Radio Melbourne.
And there is a lot to get to. Of course, we are now in a regional war. There's no doubt about it. We know that the US president has spoken yesterday. He's warned of a big wave of strikes yet to come. But he laid out, interestingly, a couple of objectives, which I find in some ways, well, contradictory to each other, but let's just give it a red hot go. Destroying the regime, this is Iran's, ballistic missile stocks and its capacity to produce new ones. Annihilating the Iranian Navy. 10 ships have already been knocked out and were at the bottom of the sea, he says. And preventing Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon, which is the thing that Australia is really backing in. Like, that's one of our reasons for supporting this. And stopping Iran from arming, funding and directing proxy militant groups. So, no direct mention, although a lot of implication about regime change. Raf, how's it looking?
Oh, I mean, it looks like regime change is a nice to have, not a must have. I think the easy way to think about what America is saying is everything we don't know is a lot longer than the list of all the things we do know. So we don't even know how long it'll last. Like, I woke up this morning and you hear Trump say 5 weeks. And in all honesty, and this is not dissing him, I don't know if 5 weeks means 5 days or 5 months. And I say that because you don't really know when to take him literally. Last year, he said they'd obliterated Iran's nuclear program. Now we sort of have to obliterate it again. But it makes it very difficult for everybody to know what they're doing. When you mention regime change, we don't know what they are trying to do. Something really struck me. So Pete Hegseth's the newly rebadged Secretary for War, not Secretary of Defense anymore. Like, I don't know if you heard him say this, but he said that this time America's going to have no stupid rules of engagement, no nation-building quagmire, no democracy-building exercise, no politically correct wars. So all we really know, PK, is we know regime change, like, maybe, but they're not pushing for it. They're not building a coalition. They're not going to the UN. They're not sharing intelligence with countries like Australia. They're not even trying to persuade through the media. You know, like, this is it. We're in a new place. He doesn't even need to build a coalition in the media or globally. He just announces, Donald Trump, on his own social media company, Truth Social, that we're at war. So there's way too much we don't know, which makes everything hard to predict, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it's very hard to know what's going to happen in 1 hour, let alone, you know, in the next week. So, yeah, I think that's right. The other element here is I just interviewed somebody, and the interview will be played later on Afternoon Briefing for people who watch us on the news channel. And I found it really interesting. So it's an analyst who's, you know, kind of concerned about the direction some of it's taking. And basically there seems to be, and I know that Rest in Politics, the podcast as well, raised this, a bit of eyebrow raising from those who believe the international rules-based order and the, you know, the structure of how you go into these things about Australia and Canada being so, well, supportive, I think it's fair to say, of this action.
Well, they don't seem to care, do they? They don't seem to care about our nation, and keep in mind, remember, Canada's Prime Minister's coming here and he made all that news at Davos, right, saying we've all got to pay attention to the new reality. I personally think it's worth paying attention to whether or not what America's done breaches the UN Charter, breaches the rules around preemptive war, might even breach American law, because the American president's supposed to ask the Congress if he can declare war. But I think it's really interesting to actually listen to what they say, what Australia's leaders say. I asked the Deputy Prime Minister yesterday, Richard Marles, you know, how come the rules seem to come up when we're talking about our enemies, but they don't come up when we talk about our friends? And he actually, Richard Marles insisted in his interview with me, oh no, the rules-based order always matters. But in the same breath, he has to dodge an answer about whether or not any rules are being broken. I actually had a chat to James Patterson this morning, the Shadow Defence Minister, and I think he was a bit more frank. I don't know, Pico, I think you would know that oppositions can be more frank and honest in these situations simply because they're not the government. But James Patterson basically said to me, we can't control what the great powers do. And he said they are not going to be restrained in a way that they were previously. I think it's really difficult for Australia, Canada, to come up with a response. I mean, it's really might makes right, the strong against the weak. We really are in a place where I feel like the global architecture is crumbling before our eyes. I feel like it's crumbling before my eyes. I think in Marles' response and Patterson's response, I don't know how many voters, I don't think the major parties feel like that many voters care. Otherwise, they'd be making more of a fuss, right? They think voters are already ahead of this. Voters already don't think the international rules matter. I think we now are at a point in 2026. I'm not sure our politicians really think the rules make a difference anymore. Is that right?
Yeah, I think there's sort of some sadness about, oh, the nostalgia for the good old days, but absolutely a radical acceptance that it's all over Red Rover and we're living in a new era and you just have to be, you hear it in terms of some of their answers, and it's on both sides, the opposition and the government, which is, oh, you know, we're doing this because it's in our national interest, right? And the argument for the national interest is Iran sponsors terrorism and, you know, harassment in Australia, for instance, and we don't want that to continue. So that's our national interest, for instance, or a destabilised world because of nuclear weapons is in our national interest, but not the process for how to get to our national interest. That's irrelevant, it seems, or it's just lip service. I think the horse has bolted on all of that, actually, Raf, and I don't think it's just crumbled now. It's been crumbling for a long time. It's just now we're in a new reality where it's unfolding right in front of us. Now, the government has, you know, very little power, let's be honest, our government. But what it says matters, and the way people perceive what it says matters. And I think you are right that most people are probably not engaged with what rules do what. What they are engaged with and what will become a problem if Donald Trump, I mean, the fact that he's even talked about boots on the ground is so weird. And I say weird because this man literally won an election on the grounds of ending forever wars and not being a warmonger. In fact, I was speaking to someone who was saying to me, one of his most appealing traits was that he was not a warmonger. And now he's kind of shifted dramatically. And there's lots of reasons for that and lots of things that are going on, of course, in the domestic politics of the United States. But the fact that he feels so emboldened to do this, even talking about boots on the ground when the MAGA base never wanted that. They don't want to spend the money on this. More body bags of Americans will come back. How long does it last? In the meantime, in Australia, there's only one thing that matters. Sorry to say, I know other people, especially if you're listening to this podcast, yeah, do care about wars and death and all of this, and they should. But there's one thing that matters to ordinary people, and we know that is the cost of living, and that will get worse because of this war. If the Strait of Hormuz is blocked, as it appears to be, this is going to hit us hard, right? This is a really big problem for us.
Let me take it even bigger and maybe push back on you a little bit. So, yes, a lot of people don't understand
loves
the laws.
Pushing back this guy.
Well, a lot of people don't understand the laws of war, and a lot of people might already think the rules are broken. But let's just think about the things, that the huge issues that have driven our Western policies to the right. That's been migration. A lot of that migration has been fueled by wars in Syria and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The West intervened in those countries, and they produced these huge shifts through Europe that's had a huge impact on our politics. And the thing, to be honest, that really haunts me, when they invaded Iraq, it had about 20 million people. And we saw what a calamitous catastrophe that was. The West stayed out of Syria. That was 25 million people. That's had a huge impact on the radicalization of our politics and the rise of populism. Iran is 90 million people. it's a nation that sits between Asia and the Middle East. So if that really goes as pear-shaped as a country like Iraq or Syria, we're talking about something a lot bigger than, you know, the rules of war and international laws around armed conflict. You are talking about a major change in migration flows around the world. That feeds directly into our politics and directly into where inflation goes. But maybe we should wind things back a bit, PK, and think a bit about...
You be in charge.
Well, I just wonder if you want to think a bit more about what Michelle Bullock's actually saying and what might be coming when it comes to interest rates.
What
and inflation.
Is she saying? I mean, she's saying lots of things. She's doing her usual, which I respect thoroughly, which is hedging. Yes. She hedges.
Although she's, I don't know if you missed it. I think you might have missed it. Here's the nautical metaphor that you missed. You mentioned the Straits of Hormuz. Yes. Look it up on Google Maps. It sits between Iran and the Arabian Peninsula. Mm-hmm. Very narrow, only 30 Ks. One in five of the world's barrels of oil goes through the Strait of Hormuz. But of course, there's lots of tankers that normally go through the Straits of Hormuz. What did Michelle Bullock, the Reserve Bank governor, say? I think there's a risk that inflation expectations might become a little bit unanchored. You see the maritime connection she's making there? She knows that things are
connected. What a woman.
What a woman. But look, she states the obvious. It's not obvious how this might play out. She did say too, like, because oil's not quite as crucial as it used to be, it's hard to know if things are going to go well or badly. I think she was also pointing out America isn't nearly as reliant on oil as it used to be. It isn't necessarily the same as the oil crisis in the 1970s. But, I mean, you wouldn't want to bet on inflation, on interest rates going down next time, would you? You wouldn't. I mean, what a crazy
going
world.
Down. Well, not that I can see. I'll probably eat my hat. Something wild will happen. But the trajectory is all in the other direction, right? And it just means difficult times. The government is preparing this budget. I mean, what a headache in this context, really. It is genuinely going to be very difficult now to construct and craft the budget. At the same time, I think the Treasurer, in my own analysis, will be looking to this crisis for some cover, would I call it, political cover, as he, you know, establishes the case for why things are a little gloomy, that it's look at this, international shocks and an uncertain world. So that probably gives him a little bit of a buffer in terms of his framing as well. Difficult, but also, you know, hoping that people might see that the world is a fragile and unpredictable place, and that's putting pressure on the government. But, you know, Australia is now just a very small player in something that is an international calamity, and we have absolutely zero control over our circumstances, isn't
but
that
how
the truth?
Amazing is that? Well, we're normally, I think we're something like the 12th, 13th, 14th biggest economy in the world. What are there, 200 countries in the world?
Yeah, we do all right.
We're up there. And
punch above our weight.
And we feel like, and we talk, our government and our opposition talk like, we have absolutely no influence on the world.
I want to take you back to something, right, which is, well, you mentioned the RBA and that was good because, you know, nothing else matters to a lot of people more than where interest rates will go next. But what I thought was really interesting this week, and we sort of foreshadowed this in yesterday's pod, but we hadn't seen it yet, was Angus Taylor as the new opposition leader in the hot seat, so to speak, his first question time. Now, I think most people know I say what I really think. I thought it was a lackluster performance from the opposition. I would even say, and I'm going to go there, I think woeful in its direction. And I say this, I've spoken to a range of people who actually agree, even on the coalition side, their focus on ISIS brides, right? I'm not saying that there's no sort of area to ask questions on that generally. That's not what I'm saying. But to make that the first, second, you know, like just make that entire focus of the question time when a war has broken out and when the economy, I'm sorry, is you know, in the doldrums, people are feeling terribly bleak. Look at all of the opinion polling. The One Nation thing isn't on its own, mate. It's not just about, you know, vibes and how people feel about Islam. It's not. It is a grievance vote about how people are feeling about their economic conditions. And we have an opposition that didn't even ask questions on the economy. And I thought, are they joking? Like, what are they doing? What is going on?
I know what we were talking about on the radio this morning was petrol prices, right? Who is the one person in the chamber yesterday who asked a question and was treated actually with seriousness and credibility, who asked a question about how much petrol have we got left? Barnaby Joyce.
One Nation MP, yeah. Former National, Barnaby Joyce. One of the best questions, I've got to say, that was asked of the day. What is our reserve?
And it did give the government a chance to say, look, we're doing better at this than the coalition. I think, you know, if you talk about air fuel, I can't remember the numbers, but if you're talking about fuel for planes, fuel for diesel, fuel for cars, we've got something like 30 days worth of fuel either on Australian soil or in ships that are in Australia's economic zone. But I just found Angus Taylor's focus on ISIS brides completely underwhelming. I mentioned to you last time I was on, Peter Dutton was focusing on these issues when there was a by-election in Melbourne. I just don't think these things, yeah, sure, you can ask about it. I don't think they have wide resonance. Barnaby Joyce asked about petrol. There are people queuing up in Melbourne this morning with jerry cans. The cheap fuel stations had traffic jams outside of them. I think it's panic buying. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's signs that show people need to buy fuel yet. But Barnaby Joyce was asking about that. He asked a sensible question. It gave the government a chance to beat up on the opposition. But I think it's fundamentally underwhelming. Mm. But maybe that's a good way for us to also talk about what happened in the Senate yesterday, because the coalition departed from the government on this censure motion for Pauline Hanson. How important is the censure motion, and what did you make of what the coalition did?
Yeah, so the censure motion was on Pauline Hanson's comments on Sky, where she said, you know, basically no good Muslims. She kind of tried to walk it back, but I don't even really think it was much of a walk back. But, you know, things have been said since. So the Senate got together to try and censure her. That's kind of, what is that? It's like a parliamentary rebuke, you know. It's not a suspension. You're not kicked out of the parliament for a few days. That happened to her over the burqa. But it's a sort of message of not happy, right? Like, we think that you've done the wrong thing. Now, the coalition did support the rebuke of the comments, but not of the censure. And I think that's interesting. What's more interesting is that two Liberal senators crossed the floor. One of them was in my Four Corners documentary, so I was not surprised. Andrew McLaughlin, South Australian Liberal, who is very worried about politics becoming racist, essentially, and unkind. So he crossed the floor, and so did Paul Scar, who was the shadow immigration spokesperson demoted by Angus Taylor. He also quit. They thought that, you know, might seem just like just words and some, you know, I know it doesn't have really a material impact on normal people's lives, but a censure is more strong, basically. And they thought that the censure should be supported. Coalition's defending themselves, saying, hang on a minute, we still said it was bad. We just didn't want to censure her. Seems a little bit like column A, column B, like I don't know what matters. But they did depart from the other parties, though, in the condemnation. And why I think that's interesting is there can only be one reason, I think.
Preferences.
Which is that they are worried about votes bleeding to the right, and they don't want to be seen as too strong in condemning her. Is that my read, yours?
I think that's 100% the read. They're eyeing off a preference deal. They haven't made a decision about preferencing One Nation. I'll pose a provocative question to you, PK. Do you think there is a world, is there any political world in which the coalition does not censor a politician if they say there is no such thing as a good Jew? There is no world in which the coalition would countenance that being said about any other religion except Muslims. And not voting to censure Pauline Hanson for that, I think it leaves them wide open to the interpretation in Penny Wong's words. They're trying to out Pauline. Mm. And it's really, it leads them down a path that is potentially dangerous.
What I don't understand, though, Raf, is where this all lands. So let's accept on face value their argument, which is, no, we did criticise her and we supported mm-hmm. that element. So they did, right? There's no criticism from them, to be fair. But in voter land, like, I'm genuinely confused about this. Does your normal punter who wants to vote for a right-wing party, whether it be Liberals or maybe now One Nation, think, well, thank goodness that coalition didn't censure that woman. They only said she shouldn't have said the no good Muslims line. Come on. Like, am I missing something? I barely can tell you the difference between those things. And I've been in this building for 25 years. I mean, what message are they sending? Is it so they can kind of speak to two different audiences? That's what it is, isn't it?
Well, it's so they can get their message right on Sky and when they go on a 24-hour news channel with you. So it's important to that audience. And that is an unimportant Like, they do need to be able to, with you and on Sky, say, oh, look, we don't like what you said, but we don't like what the government was doing. I mean, I hate to get super meta and pull back the long historical lens, but once you let the race genie out of the bottle, it's a race to the bottom. And the coalition's now in a race for votes on the right, and One Nation's a serious threat. They're trying to distinguish themselves, if I've got my coalition tactician hat on. They're trying to say, we hear your concerns, but we think Pauline Hanson goes too far. I don't think anyone hears that message. It does give them a little bit of wiggle room when they're doing, you know, part of the daily media cycle. But how many people are actually plugged into that daily media cycle who have not made up their mind yet? They're in a diabolical place. And it goes back to actually what you mentioned about Angus Taylor and his performance in Question Time. You're in a much better place if you're beating up on the government and you're actually striking effective blows on cost of living, on petrol, on inflation. You're in a much weaker place if you don't have a good economic argument, and then you're sort of trying to distinguish yourself from Pauline Hanson on Muslims and say you're kind of sympathetic to her voters but not to her views. You're in a very difficult place. I mean, isn't that how they got themselves to one of their worst election results last year?
Oh, look, it's a pickle of the highest order, isn't it? I mean, that trying to walk this sort of weird line, and on face value, it didn't look like a success to me yesterday. Thought there were some powerful speeches from people like Penny Wong. And I think you're right about, you know, there are no good Jews, if that was said.
Can you imagine? There would be no countenancing of that.
And by the way, and shouldn't be. Right?
Of course shouldn't not. Be. I know, but we shouldn't countenance about any religious group. Like, they're all Australians. And
it's
the
insane.
Point is, I get it from a tactical point of view. They're basically trying to, you know, have their cake and eat it too. And it leads you down a difficult place where someone can pick holes in your logic, but I don't know what the answers are. And they don't know what the answers are. That's why they were tying themselves in knots in the Senate. They don't know what the... One other question for you. I watched a lot of that Senate debate and there were some really strong things said. Lydia Thorpe had some really strong things to say. Pauline Hanson had some strong things to say. Penny Wong had strong things to say. Sarah Hanson-Young from the Greens. Was that performative or powerful? Do you think it was good that we had that debate and we had that fight in the national capital, in the Senate, and we thrashed out the issues? Or was it all performative and hypocritical and a waste of time?
I wasn't sure. But I have spoken to a couple of people who are more ordinary people, right?
Do ordinary people watch Parliament?
No, but ordinary yes. Muslims.
Yes.
So when you're, I can tell you from being in a couple of different minority groups, when your group, and you would know this too, is at the centre of a political discussion.
It's horrible.
Mm-hmm. But if you're at the centre of discussion, like my community was over gay marriage, there's other things, right? You notice. You notice, you might not watch Parliament, but you know, because you feel, oh, surveilled, right, by the country. So you say, was it just theatre, just blah, blah, blah. Muslims, not all, I mean, I'm sure some missed it, but a lot of Muslims heard that there was a censure of Pauline Hanson from the Parliament about them not being good Australians, essentially, no good. And that was good. That is good that Muslims heard that the majority thinks that's not okay. So I think in that sense, there is a reason you do it, right?
I think I also had the thought, like, Pauline Hanson got to say what she got to say. Sarah Hanson-Young got to interject for the Greens. There was a part of me, I actually had this thought while I was watching it last night on my phone, sorry, yesterday afternoon. I thought, you know what? I don't agree with a lot of what was said. A lot of the people in that red chamber didn't, yeah, they really got upset with each other. But maybe that's actually really valuable that we have a place where that can be said, where someone can referee and umpire and sort of chair the discussion, and we had a vote and we thrashed it out. But there's also a part of me that feels like you never really get to the absolute meat and bones of the issue. But look, it's better that we have that conversation there and that we've got a place to have that conversation.
Yeah.
Because a lot of countries just don't have that venue.
No, they don't. Look at, you know, that's sort of the discussion around Iran. And of course, at the moment, you know, like, yeah, I feel like I often say I won the postcode lottery, I'm sure, about living in this country. And I think we should acknowledge the relative, because of course, not everyone's equal here, but, you know, the relative safety of our existence. And our right to have speech and to have debates. But as I say, I think that the big powerful message was that the majority of the parliament does think Muslims are good people, because they are. Look, one more thing before we go. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney lands in Sydney and then will address the parliament. Australia and Canada, as I mentioned before, timing is everything, are the two countries that have been pretty positive about the US action. So that's something, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I think it's hugely important that Mark Carney is coming here. If anybody missed his speech at Davos, it's all based on Vaclav Havel's story about the shopkeeper taking the sign out of his window, just acknowledging the reality of the world around us. Read the original Vaclav Havel speech. Look at Mark Carney's speech from Davos. It's powerful. Our leaders are grappling with the global architecture that is crumbling before our eyes. We are, in some ways, the world's last best hope. The US, China, and Russia have really given up on the rules-based order. Canada and Australia, it matters to us more than others. We've got a lot more diplomatic and financial and economic power than those countries. It makes it really hard for us if we're arguing in a WTO court that there shouldn't be a tariff on our wheat or our lobsters. Why do the rules matter then? But they don't matter when our number one ally, America, launches a war. It's a really difficult conversation for our leaders to negotiate. It can only be a good thing if another country, I think Canada's economy is a bit bigger than ours. I think they're the 9th or 10th biggest economy in the world. If he's here, if he's run two of the major central banks in the world, England and Canada's, and he's the new PM, and he gets to chat to our PM, and importantly, if he gets to chat to our opposition and our minor parties, we are, you know, the middle powers might actually have some influence, some sway on America, on Russia, on China. So I think it's one of the more important meetings our parliament's hosted in a very long time.
I think that's right. Raf, thank you.
Always a pleasure, PK.
That's it for Politics Now today. Tomorrow I'll be joined on the podcast by David Spears for the latest. And if you have a question for us, send a short note to thepartyroom@abc.net.au. Fran and I will endeavour to answer it.
In the country, it's unusual to give away your chickens.
It's definitely going to raise eyebrows. Everyone in rural Australia knows you just don't give away laying chickens. So, 2 decades ago, when a family on the outskirts of an isolated town called Nanup in Western Australia started getting rid of things.
And she's saying to Chantel, are you sure that you want to let go of these things?
People started noticing.
And Chantel said, yes. Leela's not going to need them anymore.
Daddy, stop doing that fight.
I'm Dominique Bayens, and I live and work about 45 minutes away from the little blue farmhouse where those 4 people lived and disappeared from.
The family lived a bizarre alternative lifestyle.
Chantel and Leela McDougall, Tony Popich and Simon Cadwill vanished in July 2007.
Hey, somebody do the castanets. I'm feeling all Latin now.
They left behind a note saying they'd gone to Brazil, and rumours of a dark online cult swirling in their absence. They were never conclusively seen again.
They have not accessed their bank accounts or travelled overseas on their passports.
What began as a missing persons case morphed into an international investigation as evidence of secrets, hidden identities and a mysterious cult leader emerged.
He was working the room. It was like a car salesman trying to sell you a bomb.
Something wasn't right.
Outlandish theories became distinct possibilities.
He told someone online that he was planning a family suicide pact, but later changed his mind.
I always thought that was their grand plan, to go to South America. This is where I have to take a deep breath here, all this stuff, because, yeah.
Why didn't we see any signs?
For months, I've been picking at the threads of this story to find out who the Nanup 4 were and what led them down the rabbit hole and into the face of disaster. And the further I've got, the more I've realised nothing is what it seems in this story.
I'm a non-gossip person, but it's very easy to hear lots of gossip.
Check that out.
He said, Chantel's got end time syndrome.
Oh boy, he's weird.
I thought. To me, it was off the planet.
It's very strange.
My son's going, what is going on?
That's what happens when you cheat, see?
Namaste.
I was starting to think this is not going to end well.
There are so many people left behind looking for answers. all the while trying to face two stark possibilities. Was the disappearance a choice, or was it murder?
It turns out he wasn't trying to hurt them.
Beat them all.
He was actually trying to warn them.
All trying to work out how to live with the choices they made or didn't make that led them here.
I just wished I'd asked a lot more questions no matter what.
I'll regret it till the day I die.
I'm Dominique Baines.
I didn't want to lose her.
I can't change the past.
And this is season 6 of Expanse, the Nanup 4.
You've got two choices, be strong or be weak.
Subscribe to Expanse to hear the whole story.